This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Back when she was very young, one of Anita O'Day's first auditions as a jazz singer was with the Benny Goodman Band. Goodman rejected her, saying that she didn't sing the melody. But that was one of her gifts, to improvise on the melody and to swing. She first became known in 1941 when she joined the Gene Krupa Band. She later sang with Stan Kenton, Benny Goodman, and many small groups. Anita O'Day died in 2006 of a heart attack at age 87. A documentary about her, called Anita O'Day, The Life of a Jazz Singer, has been making the rounds at film festivals and theaters for the last several months. It was directed by Robbie Cavallina and Ian McCrudden and has just come out on DVD. Here's an excerpt from the documentary. You'll hear the voices of Anita O'Day, of jazz pianist and educator Billy Taylor, and of jazz critic Bill Friedwald, who speaks first.
A famous story about Anita that even back in the 40s, when she was still a band singer, that band singers were always these really glamorous creatures that wore these big flowing evening gowns, and it was very difficult, you know, for these poor girls to manage this while they were on the road. You know,
you gotta be pretty and you gotta wear a dress, but they don't move. Love is a many splendor thing. She looks gorgeous, she don't move.
And Anita was the first one to insist on just wearing a regulation band uniform and a skirt, you know, not to do the full glamour route.
When Gene was doing it very well at the Paramount Theater, he hired a tailor to give them an outfit, two outfits, one for on the road with green slacks and a checkered jacket and everything, and I just asked him if I could have a skirt and jacket made. Mm-hmm. And I set that trend, played it like one of the guys.
She's like one of the guys in the band, because that was her training, and she knew how to handle all those kind of situations where she was the only woman or whatever. But she was fun.
I got to be one of the guys so much, I used to have the girls waiting for me. Where I
could,
well, no, too late.
In her 1981 autobiography, High Times, Hard Times, O'Day explained that her last name was Colton, but she changed it to O'Day because in Pig Latin, O'Day meant dough, and she hoped to make plenty of it. Unfortunately, most of the money she did make from her records and concerts went into her arm. She had always been a hard drinker, but in 1954, she started using heroin. It wasn't until 15 years later that she kicked that habit. Anita O'Day, The Life of a Jazz Singer, includes excerpts from a number of radio and television interviews with her, including one she recorded with Terry Gross, which we're about to hear. It was in 1987, during our first year as a national daily show on NPR. At the time, O'Day was 68 years old and appearing at a club in San Francisco. Before we hear that interview, here's Anita O'Day in 1959 with a band led by Jimmy Giuffre.
Someday when I'm awfully low and the world is cold, I will feel a glow just thinking of you, just the way you look tonight. Ew, ew, ew. With your smile so warm and your cheeks so soft, there is nothing for me but to love you, just the way you look tonight. With each word your tenderness grows, tearing my fears apart, and the smile that wrinkles your nose clutches my foolish heart. Lovely, never, never change. Keep that breath a spark. Won't you please arrange it for I love you, just the way you look tonight. Ooh, 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 ooh. Do it.
Anita O'Day, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, good morning. Is it morning where you are? Well, it's morning somewhere, right?
It's morning somewhere, that's right.
That's right, because I just come back from Europe, and it takes like days for you to get used to like the 10-hour difference.
You know, throughout your career, you've always not wanted to be the, quote, girl singer, the person who's accompanied by the band, accompanied by the orchestra. You've always said you wanted your voice to be part of the band.
Right.
Would you explain some of the things that you did and didn't want as a singer with a band?
Well, the things I did want was to be there, because you learn and you earn while you learn. Nothing wrong with that one. The band work is really very simple work. It's called pattern work. And you mostly sing quarter notes, and the band fills with patterns. Pleasure, you're about. The band goes, do-wah. You know what I'm talking about?
Uh-huh.
So it's called pattern work. And then, after Gene Krupa Orchestra for 5 years and Stan Kenton for 1 year, this is a few years back, I decided that I would like to try for a small group, which is different kind of work.
You have a very unique voice, and physically, one of the reasons for part of the uniqueness of your singing is that you don't have a uvula.
You read my book.
I did read your book. Can you tell us about how you lost your uvula? And I should say that that's the little fleshy overhang in the back of your mouth.
That hangs down in the back of the throat when you see the cartoons and it shows her singing and that little thing's going, well, that's gone. I was in the hospital for just regular bit of tonsils or something. I think I was 7 years old, and my mother said, years later, I said, you know, I want to be a singer, and I've really got a problem. I can't get any vibration going. I have to make a different type. And that's when she told me about this uvula having been, it was a slip of the knife.
During the tonsillectomy?
Yeah, during the, tonsillectomy, right.
So
that's how that went down.
How did that change your singing?
Well, not knowing about it from 7 years old and not knowing I was going to be singing at 20 and still singing at 68 years old, it didn't make much difference because you find a way to do it, because where there's a will, you know.
Before you even sang professionally, you picked up some money in walk-a-thons and dance marathons during the Depression. Did you have an endurance record? Do you remember what your record was for a number of hours danced or walked?
Well, I was in six contests, and I came in 4 out of 6 contests. And the longest one I was in that I can remember, Red Skelton was the night MC, and June Haver was in the show, and Frankie Lane was in the show, and we were all in the show, whatever. But we were still in the show 2,328 hours.
That's a lot. Do you think this was good practice for being on the road?
Well, you got to learn something from it. I hope I did.
Anita O'Day is my guest. When you were singing with big bands, you were usually the only woman in the band. And I think it was always a source of pride for you that you could, you know, keep up with the men in every way. In your book, you wrote that you were proud that you carried your own bags, you paid your own checks when you were with the Krupa band.
Yes, Yeah, I sort of became one of the guys because that was the only way to play it, you know? I mean, I guess you could play it girl, but I haven't played girl yet. Let's see, I'm 68. I'm going to play girl next year because I'm always too busy.
But what does playing girl mean to you?
Just that. You know, you wear girls' clothes and you don't pick up your own bags. I've been wearing slacks since 1932.
Well, actually, you mentioned in your autobiography that because you sometimes, when you were on the road, wore a real simple outfit, a band jacket and just a simple skirt, that some people figured you must be a lesbian because you weren't wearing a gown.
Well, how about I was wearing the jacket of the band, and the skirt idea was like an idea I had, and Gene went for it, you know. The next thing you know, the modern eras were doing the same thing. It's a matter of convenience, which is what life is all about, where I work it is.
You used to sing duets with trumpeter Roy Eldridge. Was there any resistance at that time, and this is the early 1940s, to having a black performer and a white performer singing duets on the same stage?
Well, I think there was something going on out there. It didn't bother me. I'm from Chicago. I went to colored schools. You know, that didn't bother me. When we played the South, it was really horrendous at that time, right?
There were negative reactions from the audience or from the club owners who caused the problems?
In the South, it was just the people for him to get into the theater, let alone perform. You know, in New York City, there was no problem.
I want to play the first really big hit that you have, play an excerpt of it. This was, you recorded this in 1941 with Roy Eldridge.
With Roy, yeah, I do it every night. Yes, I call it my nostalgia portion, and I do Let Me Off Uptown.
What's the story behind the record? How did you get to do a duet on this?
Oh, I have no idea. Gene bought it from somebody who made the arrangement and taught us how to do it.
And
it belonged to Gene. It was in his books.
The record sold, I think, 1.5 million copies?
That's the one Gene bought a house in Yonkers. Yeah, that's right.
Well, let's play an excerpt of it. This is my guest Anita O'Day, as recorded in 1941.
Right.
What do you mean, Joe? My name's Roy.
Well, come here, Roy, and get groovy. You been uptown?
No, I ain't been uptown, but I've been around.
You mean to say you ain't been uptown?
No, I ain't been uptown. What's uptown?
If it's pleasure you're about, and you feel like stepping out, all you've got to shout is, let me off uptown. If it's rhythm that you feel, then it's nothing to conceal. All you've got to spill is, let me off uptown. Rib joints, juke joints, hip joints. Where could a fella go to top it? If you want to pitch a ball and you can't afford a hall, all you've got to call is, let me off uptown.
Anita, oh Anita, say, I feel something.
What you feel, Roy? The heat?
No, it must be that uptown rhythm. I feel like blowing.
Well, blow, Roy, blow.
Anita O'Day, how did that record change your life?
Well, it didn't change it too quickly because at that time there was no union for girl singers. I made $7.50.
From a million and a half selling record?
That's right. He built a house in Yonkers.
My goodness. Uh-huh. You played with several other big band leaders in addition to Krupa. You performed briefly with Benny Goodman, and you described him as a band leader who always tried to distract attention from the performer so that... Why, so that they wouldn't take attention away from him?
Yeah, well, that was just his style. I don't think he did it maliciously. That, you know, that was just his way.
How would he do it?
Well, for instance, if I've scheduled to do four tunes and the people are giving me too much attention, he would just automatically go into Sing, 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 which is his tune, and I'd have to leave the stage waving goodbye. Yeah.
You describe Stan Kenton as being incapable of swinging.
Yeah, Stan couldn't swing. I mean, I love Stan, and I love his upbeats. And he was the artistry and rhythm. And that's funny, because when I was with the band, I was there for a year. I sat on the stage like the Gene Krupa Orchestra. And at the end of these extravaganzas, Stan would go, da-da-da-da, or whatever, and the band is holding this note. And he'd look over at me like, when do I cut it off, you know? If he did it on his own, he'd cut it off at 6 7/8. I never heard of it. But I'd get him to cut it off on 4. So I did that for a year, you know, just trying to be helpful.
We're listening to Terry's 1987 interview with jazz singer Anita O'Day, who died 3 years ago at age 87. A documentary on her life and music called Anita O'Day, The Life of a Jazz Singer, has just been released on DVD. Here's O'Day in a recording from 1960.
I saw you last night and got that old feeling. When you came in sight, I got that old feeling. The moment that you danced by, I felt a thrill. And when you caught my eye, my heart stood still. Once again I seemed to feel that old yearning, and I knew the spark of love was still burning. There'll be no new romance for me, it's foolish to start. For that old feeling is
still in my heart. I saw you last night, got that old feeling when you came in sight.
Let's get back to Terry's conversation with Anita O'Day, recorded in 1987.
You've had a lot of hard drinking in your time, and you've also done a lot of drugs in your time. Do you think that your involvement with alcohol and drugs had anything to do with wanting to keep up with the men, as we were talking about before, and wanting to be as tough as they were?
That's a good question. Never thought about it that way. No, I do it because I enjoy it. You know, everybody has their things, and that's what I do. You know, I didn't want to have a family. I didn't want to sit at home. I didn't want to be a housewife and own property. And I didn't want to work in an office from 9 to 5. And so I was just out there looking to find something that I could, like, go along with, you know, and maybe contribute to the people in the world.
You started smoking grass when you were 12 or 13 years old, and that was...
It wasn't against the law then, Terry.
That's the amazing thing. You know, it's hard for me to think of a time before marijuana was illegal.
Yeah. Well, I didn't look for it. It's just the people that were going my way, that's what they were doing, you know.
There was a period of, I guess, close to 15 years when you were using heroin and still performing most of that time.
True.
Did the musicians who were users stick together and all know who each other were?
More or less, yes.
Why was it important to stick together?
Well, to see who had the newest connection. What else? Come on, Terry.
I guess it was hard to find contacts when you're on the road, as you always are when you're a musician.
Whatever. That's one of them, yeah. That's not my problem anymore, so I really could care less, you know.
When you were convicted several times on drug charges, how difficult did that make it for you to get bookings in certain cities that had...
It helped. That's showbiz.
Seriously, it helped? I can't tell if you're kidding or not.
No, I'm not kidding. That showbiz, it does. It helps you. They come to look at the girl that went to jail for smoking dope. I don't say that happens today because it's too popular today, and the kids grew up and they say, well, that's a scam, you know. But at that time, that was part of it, man. I'd work a club and they'd be standing out down the street around the corner getting in to see the girl just get out of jail. Yeah.
That make you pretty angry?
Didn't make me angry. Business was great.
Right.
Come on, where are you?
How did you finally kick after?
Oh, I went to Hawaii. I went to Hawaii, and I didn't know anybody in Hawaii. And when you get the chills, I just laid in the hot sun. And when you get the sweats, I jumped in the water. I did it for 5 months, cool, cold, and straight ever since.
Did you have to almost relearn how to sing straight after you'd been performing high for so many years?
Oh, yeah, you kind of have to work around it, right. That's why I went back to the nostalgia things, because I'd been doing bebop and whatever else, and so I went back to before that time, and that's what I'm doing now.
I recently had the opportunity to see a movie that I suspect a lot of our listeners have seen, Jazz on a Summer's Day. Mm-hmm. Which was a performance at the Newport Jazz Festival.
Oh, I was feeling no pain that day.
Really?
This is what... I was on 60 Minutes, and Harry Reasoner asked me the same thing. He says, that day when you were on Jazz on a Summer's Day, and you were out there in that big picture hat, and the breeze was blowing those real ostrich feathers on top of it, he says to me, were you high? And I looked at him, and I looked back at the little film they were showing me, and I says, I would say yes. That was 60 Minutes.
Well, you know what I really wanted to know was how you were wearing these great white gloves in it, these, like, I think wrist-high white gloves, and it's very sharp-looking. I don't know how many women were actually wearing those gloves back in 1958, but how did you decide to wear them? I think it almost became a trademark.
Well, I went to George Ween, who was the promoter of the whole thing. And I said, what night am I on? Because it was Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday nights. And he says to me, oh, you're on Sunday afternoon. And I said, oh, thanks a lot. You know, what am I going to wear on a Sunday afternoon? I'm not going to wear a frock to the floor. And I'm not going to wear it off the shoulder. So I got to thinking. So I lied prone, and I kind of, like, thought, what would you wear? I was due at 5 o'clock. So I wore a cocktail afternoon cocktail party dress with the black sheets and the white peplum and little glass slippers and the little white gloves and this black hat with the ostrich feathers. And that worked out apropos for the time O'Day. That's a joke. O'Day. Terry. Hello, Terry, are you there? Yeah, that's what happened, love.
Oh, yep, goodness.
That was it.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much.
Well, I want to thank you for even considering me. It's very nice of you to bring me forward to all the listening fans of your age, and I appreciate it. Thank you, Terry, and my best to fresh air. Is that what it's called?
Yep.
Let's have some fresh air, and I'm with you, babe. I'm with you, babe. Check it out.
Jazz singer Anita O'Day speaking to Terry Gross in 1987 during our first year as a national daily show on NPR. The singer died in 2006 at age 87. A documentary about her, Anita O'Day, The Life of a Jazz Singer, has just been released on DVD. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. As a cartoonist and writer, Harvey Kurtzman was a key influence on modern adult comic books, and, some would say, on satiric humor in general. He created the comic book Mad, which later would become Mad Magazine. Music critic Milo Miles says that the span of Kurtzman's work has been brought into focus with a richly illustrated new biography called The Art of Harvey Kurtzman, The Mad Genius of Comics.
Since I grew up as a comics fanatic, Harvey Kurtzman should have been a natural hero to me. He invented Mad Magazine. His satiric stories and pictures inspired superb underground comic artists like Robert Crumb, Art Spiegelman, and Gilbert Shelton. But when I was a teenager in the late 60s, it was hard for me to find Kurtzman's best work. The early issues of Mad that he oversaw were long gone, to say nothing of the groundbreaking realistic war stories he'd done earlier for EC Comics. Kurtzman's current work at that time was done with his favorite artist collaborator, Will Elder, namely Little Annie Fanny in Playboy magazine, a strip he did for 26 years. It was the most gorgeous-looking few pages of comics imaginable, but it wasn't exactly slashing, burning satire. I couldn't know that Kurtzman had a much more cynical, sardonic view of sexuality than big boss Hugh Hefner, but that one was not allowed to dissent from the Playboy philosophy within the magazine itself. Kurtzman passed away in 1993, just 5 years after the end of Little Annie Fanny, and it was easy for an uninformed person of my age to think, maybe the guy's overrated. Authors Dennis Kitchen and Paul Buell have done invaluable service to the man's legacy with The Art of Harvey Kurtzman, The Mad Genius of Comics. Anyone should come away convinced by their argument that Kurtzman is as important as anyone who ever worked in the field. Kitchen is an outstanding cartoonist himself, and I credit him with selecting a definitive showcase of Kurtzman's art from all phases of his career. This means not only masterpieces from the war comic Two-Fisted Tales and Mad, but vibrant devil-may-care obscurities like a satire of Archie comics from 1949 that looks like a page from Mad years before Mad existed. The Art of Harvey Kurtzman even includes one of the finest Little Annie Fanny strips, the origin story, which has never been published before. Kitchen and Buell also do an exemplary job laying out Kurtzman's jagged years after he left Mad in 1956 and before he started Little Annie Fanny in 1962. Kurtzman's three publications during this period were Trump, a lavish comic sponsored by Playboy that folded after two issues, Humbug, a comic magazine put out by an artist collective that soon crashed and burned, and Help, a satire magazine that was not primarily comics. All these magazines remain more talked about than seen for decades. Fantagraphic Books has remedied that situation in part by publishing a glorious collection of Humbug. This two-volume slipcased edition corrects the major problem with the original publication, namely that it was badly printed on incredibly trashy paper. This new Humbug offers teasing hints of what Mad might have become if Kurtzman had stayed on, more political, more adult, more outright brainy. Humbug probably went right over many folks' heads, but it seems half the folks who loved it as kids became influential cartoonists. Humbug's failure to thrive is typical. There's a persistent pang of sadness that runs through Kitchen and Buell's narrative. Harvey Kurtzman was a hopeless businessman who tried to run businesses. He was a perfectionist who scorned deadlines, trapped in an industry that demanded work banged out on time. Ultimately, he was a man who needed a manager, but would never accept anyone capable of doing the job. Kurtzman's fundamental conviction was that cartoons should use satire to cut through fantasies rather than promote them. During his apex years in the 50s and 60s, he was a powerhouse who used both his words and pictures to show a world in which the search for goodness and truth was met by nothing but liars, hustlers, bullies, and fools, all of them caught up in a wickedly funny dance of delusions. No one was safe. no storytelling conventions were sacred. Kurtzman put it best in his classic mad satire, Super Duper Man, where love object Lois Payne lays it on the line to the arrogant hero. Hands off! So you're Super Duper Man instead of Clark Bent. Big deal. You're still a creep. Every puffed-up hotshot in the world forever needs a dose of Harvey Kurtzman.
Fresh Air music critic Milo Miles lives in Boston. He reviewed The Art of Harvey Kurtzman, The Mad Genius of Comics, by Dennis Kitchen and Paul Buell. For a few years now, Zooey Deschanel has done double duty as an actress and as a musician. She's appeared in such films as Almost Famous and Elf, and more recently, she's performed and recorded as half of the music group called She and Him. She is she. Him is indie rock musician Matt Ward, who goes by the name M. Ward. Zooey Deschanel's new movie is called 500 Days of Summer, a romantic comedy in which she plays a woman named Summer. Her co-star, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, plays Tom, a man who spends more than a year getting to know her, and having such freewheeling conversations as how their relationship compares to that of ill-fated punk figures Sid and Nancy.
We've been like Sid and Nancy for months now.
Summer, Sid stabbed Nancy 7 times at the kitchen. I mean, we have some disagreements, but I hardly think I'm Sid Vicious.
No, I'm Sid.
Oh, so I'm Nancy.
Let's just eat and we'll talk about it later. That is good. I'm really glad we did this. I love these pancakes. What?
Tom, don't go. You're still my best friend.
When Zooey Deschanel isn't on screen, she's likely to be in the studio. Her introductory CD, She and Him Volume 1, features her original songs and a couple of covers. The arrangements are by M. Ward, who was also featured on guitar. Terry Gross spoke with Zooey Deschanel in 2008. Here's one of Deschanel's original compositions, Change is Hard.
I'm all out of luck, but what else could I be? I know he's yours and he'll never belong to me again. I did him wrong, so don't brag, keep it to yourself. I did him wrong. I was never nice, never nice, never enough, but I can try, I can try to toughen up. I listened when they told me if he burns you let him go. Change is hard, I should know.
Zooey Deschanel, welcome to Fresh Air. When I hear your album, here's one of the things I think about that makes me think that you really love music and have a fairly diverse record collection, and that you love country music and you love jazz and you love girl groups and the Beach Boys, and somehow like all of this is reflected in the songs that you write and sing. The song that we open with, Change is Hard, has a country-ish sound to it.
Mm-hmm.
And would you talk a little bit about what you were thinking about when you wrote it? What you were thinking about musically? Or do songs just kind of come to you?
I don't know. I guess I have certain sort of chord progressions that I'm attracted to. I don't usually come at it from the point of view that I'm trying to be in a certain genre, which is probably why it sort of spans a lot of genres, because I do have a diverse music collection and my taste is kind of eclectic. So I'll just go right into it and sort of start writing. It's sort of a spontaneous thing. And sometimes things come out that I'm surprised. I didn't know that I had that impulse in me, and then it just sort of comes out.
I think a lot of people were introduced to you as a singer through the movie Elf. in which you sang a complete song and a couple of excerpts, including Santa Claus is Coming to Town. So here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to first play the scene where you and Will Ferrell meet. And Will Ferrell, of course, is a human being who was adopted by elves in Santaland in the North Pole. And he goes to New York to find his birth father. And there he works in a department store, Santaland, where he meets you, who wrap gifts there. And in this scene, you're in the department store, and here's you and Will Ferrell.
Are you enjoying the view?
You are very good at decorating that tree.
Why are you messing with me? Did Crumpet put you up to this?
I'm not messing with you. It's just nice to meet another human who shares my affinity for elf culture.
I'm just trying to get through the holidays.
Get through? Christmas is the greatest day in the whole wide world!
Please stop talking to me.
Uh-oh. Sounds like someone needs to sing a Christmas carol.
No way.
Best way to spread Christmas cheer is singing loud for all to hear.
Thanks, but I don't sing.
Well, it's easy. It's just like talking, except louder and longer, and you move your voice up and down.
I can sing, but I just choose not to sing, especially in front of other people.
Well, if you sing alone, you can sing in front of other people. There's no difference.
Actually, there's a big difference.
Well, that's Zooey Deschanel and Will Ferrell and Elf. And a little later, you think, alone and singing. You're in the shower singing in the ladies' room, and unbeknownst to you, Will Ferrell is in the ladies' room sitting on a sink duetting with you quietly, and the sound of the shower water is drowning him out, so you don't realize he's in there and singing with you until the end. So let's give that a listen.
So really I'd better scurry. Well, maybe just a half a drink more. The neighbors might think. Say, what's in this drink? I wish I knew how to break the spell.
I'll take your hand, your hair.
I ought to say no, no, no.
Mind
sir.
If I move?
At least I'm gonna say that I tried.
What's the sense of hurting my
brain? I really can't stay.
Baby, it's cold outside.
And then you turn off the shower because you're pretty alarmed knowing that he's in there. It's such a really delightful scene. Now, you got your first movie role when you were still in high school, and I think you left high school the last month of your senior year to shoot the movie Mumford. Mm-hmm. What did you like or not like about that experience? I mean, obviously, you decided to stay in that world as a movie actress.
Well, I had an amazing experience, and I was still I was finishing school. I finished high school on set, and then it was a perfect first experience because every day we'd shoot, 14 or 16 hours, and I'd be like, I love this. I never want to go home. I would get sad when they'd be like, okay, you're done for the day, and I would be like, really already? And it was so much fun that I didn't want to go home. That was a great experience. And then I went to Northwestern University for a year. And partway through the year, I auditioned for Cameron Crowe on my spring break. And they were casting this movie, Almost Famous. And somebody had fallen out of they had it cast, but the lead actress decided not to do it. And then Kate Hudson was supposed to play the part of the kid's sister, and then he bumped her up to the lead role, and then there was this empty role, and they were about to shoot, and I auditioned for it, and I found out I booked the job, and I shipped all my stuff home from school and on a just sort of a impulse.
Well, you did good. Let's hear your first scene in Almost Famous. You're walking in the door. You're still living with your mother. You're 18. Your mother's played by Frances McDormand. As you walk in, you're wearing this like big coat, and you're kind of holding it shut as if you're covering something up. So you walk in. Your mother greets you at the door, and your little brother, who ends up growing up and writing for Rolling Stone, is standing in the room also listening.
You've been kissing.
No, I haven't.
Yes, you have.
No, I haven't.
Yes, you have. I can tell.
You can't tell.
Not only can I tell, I know who it is. It's Daryl. What you got under your coat?
It's unfair that we can't listen to our music.
It's because it is about drugs and promiscuous sex.
Simon and Garfunkel is poetry.
Yes, it's poetry. It is the poetry of drugs and promiscuous sex. Honey, they're on pot.
First it was butter, then it was sugar and white flour, bacon, eggs, bologna, rock and roll, motorcycles. Then it was celebrating Christmas on a day in September when you knew it wouldn't be commercialized. What else are you gonna ban?
Honey, you want to rebel against knowledge. I'm trying to give you the cliff notes on how to live life in this world.
We're like nobody else I know.
I am a college professor. Why can't I teach my own kids? Use me.
Daryl says that you use knowledge to keep me down. He says I'm a yes person and you are trying to raise us in a no environment.
Well, clearly, no is a word Daryl doesn't hear much.
I can't live here! I hate you! Even William hates you!
I don't hate her.
You do hate her. You don't even know the truth.
Sweetheart, don't be a drama queen.
You!
Hey!
This is a house of lies!
That's Zooey Deschanel and Frances McDormand in a scene from Almost Famous, which was Zooey Deschanel's second movie. So, you know, here's something odd that I read. You know, you were supposed to play Janis Joplin in a movie directed by Penelope Spheeris, who's made a bunch of movies about punk rock. And I thought, wow, that seems so wrong to me. You have such a kind of clear, pure voice, and she had so much kind of growl in hers, and your body types are completely different. Like, what were you thinking? What were they thinking?
I think that it was, they were looking for somebody who was an actress who also could sing, and I was thinking that it would be a really fun challenge to try to portray this person. I mean, our voices, yes, are very different, and we were actually supposed to go like a year and a half ago. We were all set to make it, and then it fell through due to a lot of logistical things that I don't think I quite understand at this point, but it was a lot of work. I worked for like 6 months. I mean, it's definitely very different from who I am, but I really found her to be an interesting person once I sort of started looking into who she was.
So I have to ask you about your name. You were named Zooey after Franny and Zooey, the famous J.D. Salinger story, which so many people have read. How old were you when you read the story, and did you like it well enough to feel good about being named after after the character? Because probably throughout your life, people have been saying, oh, you're named after Franny and Zooey. So yeah. So how old were you when you read the story, and do you like it?
I actually waited a really long time to read it because I had read all of J.D. Salinger's other works, and I was sort of terrified that I wouldn't like it and that I would be living with this, you know, identity of a person who doesn't like their namesake. But fortunately, I loved it when I read it. And I was 18 when I read it. I read it the summer after I graduated from high school. My older sister was named after Emily Dickinson and Emily Bronte, and they wanted me to have a literary name too. And I think they liked the name Zooey, and they just decided to spell it that way, as you know, they love J.D. Salinger and they love that book. So I think that's why.
Well, they certainly chose a different period and different form of writing than your sister.
That's true.
Well, Zooey Deschanel, thanks so much for talking with us. And,
thank you.
Yeah, thank you again.
It was really nice talking to you. Thank you.
Zooey Deschanel speaking to Terry Gross in 2008. Her new movie is called 500 Days of Summer, and her most recent CD is called She and Him, Volume 1. In the Loop is a British political satire that takes place during the lead-up to the current war in Iraq. It's a comedic behind-the-scenes look at how the American and British governments prepared for war. It's from the writers and director of a British TV comedy called In the Thick of It, and features, among many others, James Gandolfini, as an American general. It opens today in limited release and can be seen on pay-per-view cable beginning next week. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
With its wild machinations, the riotously potty-mouthed British political satire In the Loop seems totally outlandish. But according to some reports, it's more or less what happened in the days leading up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. The Brits were indeed drafted to supply intelligence to help the administration make its case to the U.N. Security Council. And according to a leaked Downing Street memo, intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. Inspired by that memo, director Armando Iannucci has concocted a rollicking transcontinental farce, a policy wonk version of The Front Page, with characters flying back and forth between London and Washington and enough four-letter scatological invective to make David Mamet say, "Whoa, that's a tad excessive." You'll be laughing so hard you might not notice the undercurrent of horror creeping in. The movie uses characters from Iannucci's Brit TV comedy In the Thick of It, starring the Scottish Peter Capaldi as a relentlessly abusive government press secretary named Malcolm Tucker, and based on Alastair Campbell, who did the job for Tony Blair. As the film opens, he's listening to a radio interview with a minor government minister named Simon Forster, played by Tom Hollander. And Simon stammers something about the war in the Middle East being, quote, unforeseeable. And as harmless as that locution seems, it drives the prime minister, who goes unnamed, and his executioner, Malcolm, into obscenity-laced fits of apoplexy. Here's Malcolm with Hollander Simon and Gina McKee as his press secretary and a new young spin doctor, Toby, played by Chris Addison.
Are you saying I'm now no longer allowed to make media appearances?
Correct. Not until we can trust you to keep the line.
No, I was going to keep to the line. I was going to say, I don't think war is unforeseeable.
What is it then?
I don't know. Foreseeable? No.
No! No! Not foreseeable. That's f***ing declaring war. Do you want to f***ing declare war?
I'm a cabinet minister.
Yeah.
I didn't get here by screwing up every media appearance I ever had.
Write this down. It's neither foreseeable nor unforeseeable.
Right. So, not inevitable, but not...
You better work on this f***ing line.
Evitable.
You! Hey! Put the snifter out there that if the BBC ambushes a minister with another surprise question about the war, I'll drop a bomb on them.
Well, I can't do that, can I?
Does that not fit within your purview, Marie Antoinette? Well, listen, why don't you just scuttle off back to f***ing Cranford and play around with your tea and your cakes and your f***ing horsecocks? Let them eat cock. Hey, you, Ron Weasley, you do it.
You'd hardly recognize Capaldi from his most famous movie role as Peter Riegert's lovelorn Scottish assistant in the sublime 1983 comedy Local Hero. The cords in his neck stand out as he roars, and he shows up everywhere, fulminating, threatening, blackballing, blackmailing. Against him, idealists don't stand a chance, and neither does Simon, who tries to backpedal from that unforeseeable line, but who does like the attention. He gets drafted as an ally by the dovish U.S. Assistant Secretary for Diplomacy, Karen Clark, played by Mimi Kennedy, who's locked in a battle with the hawkish State Department official Linton Barwick, based on top Cheney aide David Addington, and played with delicious smug pomposity by David Rashi. The movie is crammed with characters and details, the actors playing it straight but at farcical speeds, leaping back and forth from the minutiae of protocol to problems with their teeth, to one-night stands, to leaking documents or plugging leaks. In the Loop's loopy ensemble includes the pert Anna Chlumsky as Clark's policy aide, who drafts a highly inconvenient paper on the prospect of war in which the cons far outweigh the pros, and James Gandolfini as an alpha male general who's nonetheless dead set against war. He's the only one who's seen soldiers die. They're all stupendous, but it's Mimi Kennedy, best known as Dharma's mom on the sitcom Dharma and Greg, who blew me away. She has the doggedness of a true political animal. She has ideals, but she knows how the game must be played. Some critics have suggested that In the Loop is too cynical, too committed to the idea that politicians and policymakers are either hopelessly ineffectual or downright venal. But I would submit The lead-in to the war in Iraq was an extraordinary case, a moment when almost no one in retrospect looks good, and the filmmakers don't depict the principal architects or even mention Blair, Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, or Colin Powell by name. Instead, we see their minions in a kind of kabuki ritual, going through the motions, the conclusion predetermined. In the Loop demonstrates how penetrating farce can be, madcap on the surface, brutally sane beneath.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org.